Would you rather own 100% of a little grape or 10 to 30% of a massive watermelon? Welcome to the Nine Doors Down Show, where we discuss anything and everything about commercial real estate and investing. Let's get it, get it, get it, get it.
Nine Doors Down.
John Lopez.
Nine Doors Down.
Hi, this is Tony Rose.
Nine Doors Down.
Hi, this is Anthony Pimentel.
Educating, capital raising, networking.
Nine Doors Down.
This is called a show!
All right, y'all. Welcome to another episode of the Nine Doors Down Show with myself, John Lopez, and my co-host, Anthony Pimentel. Anthony, we've had many people that has been part of our journey, but I don't think we've had anyone that has been there from the get-go of the Nine Doors Down story with this gentleman.
Absolutely. Yeah, this gentleman, I mean, he's there from the start. I mean, from our first property we acquired together, and even till now, we just kept that relationship going, and I'm glad we're really good friends with this guy.
Absolutely. So this gentleman that we're speaking about, his name is Adam Drescher. Adam spent 20 years on Wall Street, where he specialized in covering some of the largest and best performing hedge funds, mutual funds, and family offices. Prior to his role at Break of Day Capital, Adam was a multifamily realtor facilitating deals throughout Arizona. He has enthusiasm for building connections and aiding investors in realizing their financial objectives through real estate investing. Outside of work, he dedicates his time to volunteer work at his local church and serves as a board member of City Squash Brooklyn. For those listening at home, you may be stuck on the 405 freeway in Los Angeles or the 15 freeway out here in Las Vegas, or you're out battling the traffic in the middle of Manhattan. Let's welcome our featured guest, Mr. Adam Drescher.
Thanks, John. Appreciate that introduction. And yeah, I mean, you just brought back great memories of in the beginning. You're right from the beginning of Nine Doors Down, the creation. So it was amazing working with you guys right in the beginning.
You know, Adam, I have a confession that I need to tell you.
Okay.
I don't know if you remember the very first lunch when me and Anthony drove out to you out in, I think it was Phoenix or Tucson. I believe maybe it was Phoenix. I forget.
The first one was Phoenix. Yeah, we drove around. We saw a bunch of properties. Yep.
I remember sitting at the lunch table. It was you and Anthony. And I don't ever think I've ever told Anthony this, but man, I was so intimidated just hearing the talk track. I was like, I didn't know what the terms that you guys were talking about. I just knew that it was something that fascinated me. And then I just had to learn more about. That's why I'm referring to you. I was like, you were literally in my beginning phases of my multifamily career path.
Well, I did appreciate the compliment. I had no idea. I mean, I do remember that day that we looked at a bunch of properties. There's a couple in Phoenix. I think one was like maybe like 30 units. And then there was one down the block we used sort of as a price comp. We looked at that one, had the nice garden. But yeah, you're right though. I think, you know, for real estate, it is a steep learning curve in the beginning. I mean, I remember when I first got my license and sat down there and, you know, was learning all these terms. I'm like, oh my God, like there's a lot to learn here right away. But like anything, it just, you know, you talk to the right people, you look at it, you read, you do everything you need to do. And just one day, then it just hits you one day that you got it all or as much as you need to have at the time. I mean, it's always learning, but certainly that's the way it went with me as well. That in the beginning, I'm like, what is going on here? And then all of a sudden you start learning the terms and you finally feel like you feel confident about the process.
Absolutely. So Adam, before your current role as investor relations manager at Break a Day, what was life like for Adam Drescher before all this commercial real estate?
Wow, before all of it. Yeah. So, you know, my background is a little different from a lot of people getting into real estate. I actually, you know, I was born and raised in New York, and you're born and raised in New York, you know, Wall Street's beckoning you. You see it, you know, the people who live in the nice houses and apartments, that's what they do for a living. So you're drawn to it. So, you know, that's what I did, you know, right after, you know, college, you know, went right to Wall Street, did that for a good 20 years. I did a little bit of everything. You know, I dabbled in, I started off in research, then had a very brief stint in investment banking. 19-hour days are not for everybody, myself included. So that's, so then got into, went back to research briefly, then got into sales and sales trading. And, you know, loved it. It serves me well for like what I do now about, you know, cultivating relationships, really getting to learn your stuff. Loved it, but, you know, the commissions really started to dry up in Wall Street. You know, there was, they call it like the rise of the machines. You know, machine trading took over, so I needed something else to do. So I looked at small businesses initially. I mean, my wife and I, you know, purchased a franchise, and we opened it up here in Arizona. Enjoyed it, loved it. But a couple years into it, I realized, you know, something else was calling me. You live in Arizona, you get the real estate bug. It's hard not to. So, you know, got a license, you know, dabbled in single family first. And then, you know, met a gentleman one night, you know, sort of just a, you know, guy's night out watching sports and said, hey, you know, you understand numbers. You know, you really should be doing commercial or multifamily instead. And made a lot of sense to me. So I got into that for several years, you know, enjoyed it. But my whole life, I always wanted to be on the, you know, the buy side, you know, the private equity hedge fund side. And, you know, and finally got that when this last opportunity came to join Breaker Day Capital.
That's awesome, man. I mean, yeah, how was that transition, you know, from Wall Street, you know, which I don't know that space so much. I mean, I do invest, but like the grind of your, you know, getting paid through your commissions and just, you know, I don't know how it is or how crazy it can get, but how was that transition from Wall Street to real estate?
Well, it's very similar. I mean, when I was on Wall Street, you know, I was not, you know, some desk jobs, you're given a book of business. You know, here's your seat, cover these accounts, go get them. Most of my jobs was not that way. It was, all right, go build a book of business. Start calling people. Those who will listen to you, talk to them. So it's very similar to real estate in the same way that you start, you know, talking to people, developing that relationship from the ground floor. And then you hopefully do several deals with them as well. So it's very similar in that way, the way you build the book of business, for sure.
Now, with your time in Wall Street, did you have any moments in time where you literally got your teeth kicked in, but it made you a better fund manager that possibly now translates to multifamily?
Oh, for sure. I mean, there's two stories that really made me getting my teeth kicked in. You know, I worked briefly in investment banking, as I mentioned, and banking's brutal. I mean, there's actually, you know, I still, you know, as a former New Yorker, you got to read the New York Post every day. And there's actually a story today about it, a banker who literally just died at his desk, you know, 35 years old because he's working crazy hours. So investment banking is like the romanticized Wall Street job. You know, people like, oh, he's an investment banker. You know, it sounds like it's this wonderful life, when it's a grind. I mean, you're working crazy hours and they're not fun. And it's also not that they make it out that you're putting together these great deals, everything. No, you're usually getting yelled at by your boss because the graph should be orange instead of yellow. It's that type of job. So I did that for about 3 months and it was a grind. You're working for a crazy boss. So that's really the first time that I had a really bad experience. But as you said, you know, it made you tougher and we realized what I wasn't going to do. And I also realized in life, I'm not going to be that guy. That when somebody's ever, you know, younger than me, ranks lower than me on the totem pole at the firm, I'm going to help them. I'm not going to be that person who really abuses them, because that's just awful and a terrible way to go through life. So that's what was one of my first, you know, getting your teeth kicked in and learning experiences. But part of Wall Street is you do now and then have a, in quotes, trading error. I had a big one one day. It was it was entirely my fault. I'll be the first one to say it was my fault. I thought I was the smartest person in the world for 5 minutes, and I wasn't. You know, the markets will teach you that immediately. I guess the story goes that day we were at the time a lot of these healthcare drugs were not getting approved. So we had created trading strategies to take advantage of the price went down. So one of my best account at the time was short a lot of this one biotech company expecting the drug not to get approved. And the exact opposite happened. It got approved that day. So the stock opened sharply higher. And looking back at other trading patterns, I noticed that when these drug approvals happen, they would open at the height and then start, you know, going lower, lower, lower throughout the day. But they were opening at the high, closing at the low these days. So I thought, oh, okay, it opened at the high. I'm not going to buy any back for the guy because he had to buy the shares to cover the short. Well, it opened at the low that day and closed at the high. So for the good, so the first 10, 15 minutes of the trading session, I'm not buying any of the stock I need to. I'm like, it's going to go lower. It's going to go lower. It's going to go lower. Didn't go lower. It's going higher and higher and higher. And I'm there like, oh man, you know, what do I do? In the back of my mind, it's kind of those, like, you know, angel demon, one side saying, you know, your instincts are wrong this time. The other side saying, well, maybe, you know, but about, you know, 20 minutes and I finally started buying the shares. The guy, portfolio manager's like, have you bought any yet? And he's like, what are you doing? You know, I got one of those calls. So I did eventually start buying the shares. I think the error was over $18,000. So I had to, at the end of the day, go sit down with my boss. And you know, these actually do happen. You try to minimize them, but it is part of the business. But I remember sitting down there and saying, yeah, we had a bit of an error today. And he's like, and he just kind of looks at me immediately like, how much? It's always the first question. I'm like, a little bit over $18,000. And I get the backhand of the compliment. You're too smart to let this happen. I'm kind of like, well, thank you. You know, but I didn't say that because I knew how mad he was at me. But I told him what happened. And even though it made sense, you know, he clearly wasn't happy, but he kind of, you know, go fight another day. You know, the happy end of the story is the accountant did in fact, you know, make up that loss the next couple of days with commission. He paid me enough commission to cover that error the next few days, but it was a great learning experience. You know, people, you know, talk about these frightening business experiences, but if you do learn from them, they're fantastic. And I really did that day that if you're wrong, just immediately you got to pivot. And I think that's true in everything in life, even, you know, real estate. If something's not going away your way or it's not going the right way, just don't think, oh, things will change. No, you got to make that big pivot right away.
Welcome to the course on raising capital for investments. And this course will cover the following topics. 1, analyzing your investment strategy. 2, discovering potential investors. 3, crafting your pitch. 4, securing your investment. 5, our cheat code. We'll round out the program with our very own cheat code for getting in front of investors and being ready to pitch your investment opportunities. Take action today. Visit schoolofninedoorsdown.com and learn to attract capital.
We always talk about the volatility of stocks, man. Imagine if we had that volatility in real estate where it's happening within hours.
Wow. Never even thought about that one. That would be something to see.
That'll be pretty insane. So what you just describe, Adam, it's like my emotions, because I used to do that. I used to invest a lot in biotech companies, and I used to, you know, phase 1, phase 2, like I always thought I was the smartest guy for sure. All the test results show this is going to go. They're going to prove them and get to the next phase. And next, you know, it just drops and you're like, oh, okay. Maybe I'll wait a little bit, then, you know, buy again or something like that. But it's a roller coaster. It's too crazy, and it's not fun. I'm gonna tell you right now.
Oh, yeah. When somebody wants to describe biotech investing is you're playing Russian roulette. You really are, and you can think. I mean, you can talk to, you know, I'm using quotes, the experts. They don't know anything. I mean, I remember one day in one of my jobs, the analysts, they were waiting for our approval for this one drug, and, you know, 9 o'clock. Oh yeah, the panel, it went great. 12 o'clock calls in. Oh, it went great again. 2:30, it went great. 4 o'clock hits the tape, drug not approved. So it's really just, even the experts really have no great insight. I mean, they claim they do, but they really don't. So yeah, biotech investing is not for the faint of heart.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I mean, with your experience, I mean, what are your thoughts now on like the market? Like, I mean, I feel like since COVID, the market's just been going up and up. The S&P has doubled. It's like everyone's talking about a recession, this and that. It's like, where are we? It's like, you know, I would like to hear your opinion.
Yeah, it's a tough call. I mean, the market, I mean, it's soared. I mean, I would not, had you told me years ago, you know, the Dow Jones would be at 38, 39,000, I would have laughed. I would have said, like, there's no way. I mean, I know that's been sort of a long-term target for a lot of people, but this quickly, probably not. It's tough to say. I mean, the experts or a lot of people thought, you know, the recession would happen this year. It hasn't. A lot of people thought, I mean, all this negative data would cause, you know, the sell-off. I mean, I know the Fed's still printing money, you know, left and right. So that's what's, you know, seems to be keeping it afloat. But I would just say, me personally, I'm probably a little cautious. I don't see a big, you know, upside happening this year. And that's why too, in general, like, you know, we know we're all involved in real estate, and I tell people about, you know, sort of the two different things that, you know, given the choice, I would much feel a lot more safe and comfortable with your money in the real estate versus the stock market. You're not getting whipsawed. You're not dealing with, you know, these, you know, crazy, you know, price volatility. But what I think is so unique about real estate investing versus Wall Street is, you know, that Wolf of Wall Street, Matthew McConaughey's speech the first day at, in lunch, when he says nobody has a clue whether or not stocks can go up or down tomorrow. Nobody really does. My job is to get people just give me their money and just keep on trading and churning commission, is what he does. You know, what he admitted he does for a living as a private wealth manager. But what I think is so unique about, you know, multifamily, what we do is, you know, an operator can actually really can drive the price of the property, which is so unique that the value of the property is based off of the net operating income, the bottom line. And a good operator can drive that, whether or not they acquire property where rents are very low, there's cost saving metrics, other income they can add in there. But it's so unique for an investment that there's like, this is something that an operator truly can drive the value of, because, you know, a hedge fund manager really can't when it comes to a stock or a commodity. Nobody really can drive the value of the price of gold, anything like that. But real estate is something where an operator really can drive the value of the asset.
All of this is fascinating, Adam. One term, I don't know if it irks me or if it almost kind of irks me, is how they refer to real estate as an alternative investment. Because
Yes.
in my opinion, it's like land has been an asset that pretty much animals and all of humanity has been battling, you know, battling for. So, you know, how do you feel about that term, alternative investments, when it comes to real estate?
I've never really thought of it that way, but I think you're spot on that it's what, you know, it should never be considered an alternative investment. Because, I mean, I forget what the exact stat numbers are out there of like how many ultra high net worth individuals, how much money they've accumulated through real estate, but it's a staggering number. I mean, I know, you know, people who worked in Wall Street for 30, 40 plus years, and you ask them, like, where do they, you know, these are all ultra high net worth individuals now, which means, you know, $30 million of net worth outside your primary residency. A lot of these people, that ultra high net worth is coming from their home in the Hamptons or somewhere, you know, wherever, or if they're in California, Palm Springs, wherever it is. But it's a staggering number. It's a huge percent of the ultra high net worth individuals' money is coming from some sort of real estate asset. So I'm with you. It should not be an alternative asset at all. It is a hard asset that, you know, you can make money, you know, obviously with appreciation, rental income, but all sorts of different ways. So yeah, I'm with you. I think that's a mislabel to say it's an alternative investment. I mean, the only negative, you know, to real estate investing, which people are aware of, is liquidity. If you need to sell a stock, you can sell one with relative ease, but, you know, sell a property does take some time, but that's doesn't make up for it to be get that, you know, label alternative investment at all.
I've never asked anyone that on this show, but I felt like you were the right person for me to ask because you've had experiences on Wall Street and as well as on multifamily. But let's talk about your transition now. When did that transition from Wall Street go into real estate, and why? How did it get there?
Well, I think what happened was, as I mentioned, the what got me from New York to Arizona was the franchise. We had bought franchise rights and got that up and going, and we loved it. I mean, we loved having that small business. But I think in general, with franchises, they can be a headache. And I know, Anthony, I see you nodding. You're in the franchise business as well. The best case scenario you anticipate usually is off by quite a wide margin. So I think when we after year or two of this, I realized that I'm gonna have to do something else. And started looking around, and a lot of people said to me, "Hey, I mean, real estate, real estate, real estate," kept on getting brought up and up and up. When I were talking to people about what new to do, and so I just went for it. I said, "Yeah, you're right. Let me go get a license." Arizona, it's not too difficult to get a real estate license. It takes you a little bit over a month if you do it correctly, doing like the 2 weeks course, and then pass a school exam and the state exam. And then you can hang. Most places want you. You don't really have to. I know certain cities and states is different. You really have to interview for a position at a place. Arizona, they kind of want you. So you'd really talk to a place and say, "I want to hang my license here," and then they train you. So that was the next couple steps after that. But it was really, to me, the biggest transition was when I was met my the boss when I was a multifamily realtor one night. Because up to that point, I was, I think I'd done three or four single family deals. I enjoyed it, but I never really thought about commercial. The commercial part was really, new to me. So really, when it explained to me, I was like, "Wow, you're right. This is really interesting, and something I myself would, possibly want to do." I never really thought about, buying a second home, as an investment, but multifamily would definitely be something I would like. Wow, this makes a lot of sense. This is a really solid investment, and I never fully understood how the returns worked until it was showed to me that it's not just your cash flow. There's tax benefits. The property appreciates. And when you put it all together and you look at those returns, they're astronomical. And that really just blew my mind when I first started looking at the dynamics of multifamily investing.
That's awesome. I was going to ask you, because when people jump into real estate, I think the biggest thing is, not like a hedge fund or stocks they can just put their money in. With real estate, I feel like a lot of people get intimidated by that, right? And I feel like anytime you speak with someone who's new to real estate, they're just like, "Oh, I don't have a down payment for that. Oh, I don't have money." You know what I mean? So maybe you can maybe talk about that on how you educate some investors on how they can feel a little bit more comfortable. You talked about, numbers and understanding the numbers. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that and how you can get them more comfortable.
No, sure. That's a great question, and I do deal with that. Usually several times a week with somebody who's new to or wants to learn about multifamily investing, but is new to it. And the first thing I usually do with them is I tell them what you should do in your position. And what I tell everybody who's new to multifamily investing, the first thing I tell them is if you are investing in a syndication, which the people that talk to me, call me clearly are, that the most important due diligence you do is on the operator. You'll hear several terms: the operator, syndicator, CEO, president. All the terms are interchangeable, but that's where you do your due diligence first. So I tell them you want to make sure they have skin in the game, that they're personally invested. Have they done this before? What's their track record? What's their parameters that they look for a deal? So start with that when you look at a deal, and then after that, you want to look at the deal second. So people have a lot of terms for it. Some people say you're betting the fighter pilot, the jockey, not the horse. But whatever it is, I tell people that's step one. Really do due diligence and ask the operator the hard questions. Or in our case, I'm the investor relations person. Ask me the hard questions about the operator. I'll gladly answer them for you. And then you start looking at the deal. The deal is always second, but find out what's the game plan here? How long do they want to hold the property for? How are they going to really boost the NOI? What's the way? Is it rents? And if it is rents, okay, what are your rent forecasts based off of? Are they hard numbers? Are they best case scenario? What are those numbers based off of? And then the other ways too, how are you going to save money? How are you going to additional revenue streams? So really then dissect the deal second. And what I think, Anthony, your question about, you know, how do you get people, you know, comfortable about it is, you know, the one thing I think is important too, what I really love about real estate investing versus, you know, putting your money in a private equity fund or venture capital is your money's backed by a hard asset. And we've all heard the crazy frauds that have happened on Wall Street, you know, not just the companies, you know, WorldCom, Enron, the big ones. Everybody knows about Madoff. And there's been other ones too, of just, you know, there was Bayou Capital. The guy faked his own death, hopped out of a plane. And after, you know, trying to take all this money with him. So there's some crazy frauds out there. But what's so good about real estate is your money's backed by the deal you're investing in. So if your CEO decides to says, okay, tomorrow I'm gonna hop on a plane to fly to Belize and disappear, they can't take a property with them. That property is there. So that's something else that, you know, I know what we do is every property that we acquire, investors' names are not on the deed, but the property is then deeded to the LLC. So if our CEO disappeared one day, the investor's capital is very well protected. You know, people have asked me, well, what happened? I said, well, you'd actually end up making money because the property is definitely worth more now. We've done the renovations and the property would be sold and you would get your initial principal back from the profits. So that's something else I think a lot of people need to know about the process that that your property is much better protected than it would be with, you know, putting your money in a hedge fund or something like that. But the comfort level, you know, I think that's a great question to talk to people about is I've taken a lot of investors like through the process. They say, okay, what's the negative side of real estate investing? To me, the only negative out there is liquidity factor, that your money is tied up until the property is sold. That's really the only negative I can think of. The returns are phenomenal. It's a hard asset. People need a place to live. You know, real estate, you know, especially multifamily real estate, is truly recession resistant. It's done fantastic during tough economic times. So when it comes to liquidity, you know, the investors that I've spoken to about that has said, okay, so in this situation, let's take your net worth and start there and figure out what makes sense for you to invest with us. So I'll take you through like one good example was one gentleman. He is accredited, so he makes married $300,000 with his wife. Probably does have over $1 million of liquid net worth as well. He loved one of our deals, and he's working right now. So he does. So the money he has free, he did not need it per se. He can live off the money that he currently makes every year. So I said, okay, how much money do you have? And he said, I think the number was about $1.2 million of liquid net worth. So his house is paid off. He's making $300,000 a year, has $1.2 million in the bank, stocks, bonds. I said, okay, well, is there anything coming up? Like, are you paying your daughter's tuition? Are you going to buy a new car? Is there anything else out there that you really need to, big expense you have down the pipeline? And he said, no expense, but he was living in New York and said, I do want to move to Florida pretty soon. So I'm eyeing a house in Florida. I probably won't sell the New York place. And I said, okay, how much are you looking at? And I think the range was between 1 to 1.5 million. So I said, all right, let's take the high end of that range. You probably only need 30-40% down, but let's put 50% down so you're extra protected. And I said, okay, so that was $750,000. So after that, he has $450,000 left. And I said, okay, so you're probably going to want to furnish the house, maybe do some renovations. Let's put another $150,000 out of that, take away from that number. And he said, okay, that makes sense. So now he's $900,000 towards his purchase. He has $350,000 remaining. And I said, okay, well, let's also, you know, you don't want to use all your money left. Let's take some aside for a rainy day. That something unforeseen happens. And he says, great. So let's put on another $150,000 aside. And I said, okay, so $200,000 is what you have left. That would make sense for you to invest. And he said, you're absolutely right. He wants some diversity, so he ended up putting $100,000 with us. But that's one way I think a lot of people who are new to it, who are a little concerned about, you know, should take it. Is, you know, this is a great investment, much safer than the stock market, but it is illiquid. So put aside anything that you think you're going to need in the next, you know, 3 to 5 years, and what remains is the number that you should feel very comfortable investing in real estate.
Wow, that was awesome. Adam, that was amazing, man. Because what I got from that was, one, you educated the investor on how secure his investment was going to be, right? Mm-hmm. I think that from there, from that on, and then you actually walked the investor through the process and kind of like, instead of just saying, no, hey, I don't want to invest in real estate or whatever, you actually walked them through his next steps in the future of what he can do with that money. And I thought that was brilliant. You know, it I think that speaks a lot of like really talking through of like, or just educating the investor on where his, how his money can work for him. I think that's huge. Awesome, man.
No, thanks. I know that's right. That's what we do too. I mean, you know, as syndicators, we private equity, we really need to, you know, educate people about this because a lot of people are new to it. And, you know, it is frightening, you know, sometimes when you put your money to work something. I know when I cut that check to purchase those franchise rights, that was a exciting but nervous experience. I'm sure the same was with the other thing when you purchased yours.
And the franchises, you said it was a small, did you say small headache? But this was a big headache. Let me rephrase that.
Mine was a big headache. Our
big headache. Yeah, those guys are big headaches for me.
And, but was also, one thing is really nice too, that needs to be, you know, a lot of people who are new to, you know, multifamily real estate about, you know, which way to go. I mean, there's some people who look at, you know, they want to do it themselves. Other people want to put their money with a great syndicator. I mean, one thing, you know, I was for a long time, I was at the point like, oh yeah, I'd love to buy a property and just keep on 1031 and up and up and up. But I did realize at a certain point that when you put your money with a great syndicator, so many of your headaches go away as well. Headaches are on them. They're going to get the 3 a.m. phone calls. They're going to have to deal with the bad tenant. That's something that's often they're dealing with, not you. So that's something else. I think a lot of these, you know, people new to multifamily real estate investing should understand that, you know, there's the ways to go. If you want a lot less headaches, you're much better off putting it with an experienced operator who will also usually get you much better returns because they've been doing this for quite some time.
Amazing story, Adam. While you were educating your investor, obviously he was vetting you out, but you also get an opportunity to vet him out to see if he's a, you know, a good candidate to be an investor. Because I know I have had situations in the last about year and a half, 2 years where somebody was really interested in investing in a deal with us, but then I find out that they were investing their very last $50,000. Huh. And then once I found out about that, and I mentioned this several times on the podcast before, I recommended for him to just monitor and follow us for the next 6 to 12 months. Because if he really wanted to invest his last 50K, then I would be a little bit more open to it, though I'd still be hesitant because that's his very last. But at least he's absorbed our education, our marketing materials, whether it's emails or on social media. So I love that. I do want to pivot into Break a Day. And sure. For our listeners at home, so Adam, we forgot to mention this earlier. He was our broker when we closed on our very first 9-unit property in Tucson, Arizona. And a lot of that was, you know, Adam was educating us on Tucson at that time. This was back in, you know, 2020, summer of 2021, or spring of 2021. But Break a Day Capital, you guys have find a lot of success in Tucson, even to this day. What is it about Tucson that you like, and what do you like about it for the long haul, that for some of our listeners, you know, they may have not even looked into Tucson, Arizona just yet?
Sure. That's a fantastic question. We're still very bullish on Tucson. And, you know, I think that's something else that, you know, when we talked about, you know, vetting the operator and, you know, what that's a great question too, to ask them is, you know, where are they focused? Or do they take the shotgun approach, or are they much more focused on certain markets? And not just that, but the markets, like what do they love about the market? And I think that's a great question to ask an operator, because they should, if they're investing your money, their money there, they should bet, they better know this neighborhood or this city quite well. What we love about Tucson is, you know, when the population, it's a growing city. That's probably the first thing you need to look at when choosing what city to invest in. Is there a good population growth? Is this an inbound or outbound city? Tucson last year, again, I know if you ask 10 different trucking companies, you get 10 different answers, but Allied Trucking ranked, Tucson number two last year as the number two most inbound city. And I think Phoenix was number four on that list. I know everybody's curious. Charleston, South Carolina was number one. I'll get that question answered. But the so you want to make sure that there's a good, you know, population growth. This is a place that people are either, you know, going to or fleeing from. But what's also very important too about, you know, cities is the economy. And not just is the economy growing, but is it diversified? Because there are cities out there that, you know, people talk about the Rust Belt. I mean, look what happened there. You know, manufacturing, all these, you know, cars, you know, related manufacturing just wiped out a whole area. So you want to make sure that the city has a diversified economy. What are their major employers? And, you know, Tucson has great, you know, there's some very big healthcare companies there. They also have a good financial services sector. There's a lot of tech companies. You know, tech companies love desert climate for production. So a lot of tech companies are now, as Phoenix gets a little expensive, are going to Tucson. So Tucson's got a very good diversified economy, which is great. And then you want to look at sort of the economic, like what is the average household income for the area? And I think Tucson, it's in the $80,000 range. So $80,000 range, you know, a family of four, or, you know, can easily afford, you know, $1,300, $1,400 for like a two-bedroom apartment rent. So you want to make sure that the rents that you forecast in your model or the operator's forecasting match the economic like certainty. Do they match the, you know, what you know, average family for can afford? So those are some of the big things that we really, you know, like about Tucson is, you know, it's one is this inbound diversified economy, and it's a very affordable city that, you know, one bedroom you can get for like, you know, $1,000 to $1,100, two bedroom in that $1,300 to $1,400 range, which an average family for making $80,000 can definitely afford.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I think that's why we also like Tucson's everything you just said. And at the time, back in 2021, we just couldn't afford Phoenix. So Tucson was our second option. But that's some great intel. And you know what? I just actually spoke with a broker, or John and I, we were in a meeting with a broker a couple of days ago. And their biggest issue right now in Tucson is inventory. They don't have anything to sell.
Yeah, so
that's, which is a great thing. Demand, right?
No, for sure. I was going to say that's a blessing in disguise that, you know, possibly, yeah, that you guys, you know, went to, you know, got the deals in Tucson first, because I'm, you know, those huge appreciation. I mean, I don't have everything in front of me right now to look at, but I'm pretty certain that Tucson definitely, when it came to price appreciation, since what you purchased your property, I think the Tucson properties definitely have seen greater appreciation than Phoenix.
Yeah, we've seen it. So take me through. So what do you guys, with Break of Day, what are you working on now? And sure. You're still in Tucson, I'm assuming. Have you guys jumped over to any other states, or what's your focus now with Break of Day?
It's still the Southwest in general. I mean, all okay. of our deals, you know, have been in Arizona, you know, Phoenix and Tucson. But we're open to other markets. We actually have looked at some things in Nevada recently, just sort of outside of Vegas, that we like quite a bit. We've looked at properties in New Mexico as well. I mean, we're open to Utah, you know, Colorado as well. We really haven't seen anything. Those properties are pretty pricey right now. We haven't really seen anything that we think we can really boost the bottom line. I mean, we like to sort of, our big parameters, we want to be able to boost the net operating income, the bottom line, like 40% the first year. That's our really high barometer that we have. And, you know, we've done it for 9 straight deals. We're hoping to do it. We have a game plan for the deal we just closed on, Icon Spanish Trail. So that's really our parameters. That's, you know, it's a very high barometer. So we don't, as I said, we're very, very selective in what we've done. I mean, the last deal we did, was the first deal we had done in 14 months because just things are, you know, had been a little too pricey that we've seen in, you know, Phoenix and Tucson specifically. So, as I mentioned, we just closed on one deal. But one thing that we're very excited about that we just launched a preferred income fund. So this is a little different from other offerings out there. So this preferred income fund, investors who invest in this fund, their return is going to be 8%. And that's a no fees, no expenses. You know, a lot of these, you know, other funds, hedge funds, mutual funds, whatever their return they say they, often what they say they got, it's, that's pre-fees. You know, 12% becomes 8% if the hedge fund manager is taking 2% January 2nd, and then 20% of the profits, you know, January 31st at 4 o'clock in the afternoon Eastern time. So this one, it's, you know, it's an 8% return, no fees, no expenses. But so 8% right now is a solid return. That beats money markets, about 4%, 4.25%. CDs, 1 year's like, you know, 5.25%. Fixed annuities is like 6%-ish. And I think treasury bills, a 10-year right now, yields for a little bit over 4.5%. I mean, I don't look at the treasury bonds every day, but that's, so the return is great. I mean, and stock market itself is anywhere from 8 to 10% over the long term. But what's unique about this fund too is, you know, most hedge funds specifically, or venture private equity, if you want to withdraw your money, usually given one shot at the end of the year. Some places will give you maybe two. Occasionally you'll see a quarterly possible withdrawal option, but most of them, it's one time a year. End of the year, do you want any money on your money back? Tell us how much, here you go. This fund, we're giving investors after 90 days, they can ask for their money back the first week of any month. And then 45 days later, we will give you your capital back. So it is giving liquidity, which is pretty rare for a fund. But what we also, what's really unique about this for real estate investors is the 8% return, rather than pay taxes on this return, you do have the option, because it's real estate backed, that if you're in another deal that has bonus depreciation, you can use that bonus depreciation to offset your gains from this. So it's really unique. And we think this is just a good place that people can plant their money, you know, specifically between deals. If they don't, if they have, rather put their money in the bank, they can put their money here, get a great return, avoid taxes, because if they put in the next deal, it should be bonus appreciation. So it's a unique offering too. And the fact that it's preferred, it's a preferred income fund, you're, it's a little less, you know, risky. I mean, it's not that that's anything we're really concerned about, but that preferred always gets preference over common equity. So when it comes to, you know, people getting paid in this fund, you do have, you're one notch above most people.
I love that, Adam. With real estate, you could get very creative, and the avatar that you're attracting, you could be attracting a seasoned equity investor, right? But maybe at this stage in their life, you know what? Hey, they just want to make a little bit more on the distributions on the monthly, and then they may not be so worried about the equity multiple and so on and so forth. And or they just want to beat the 5% savings that the banks offer. I know with Anthony and myself, we also offer something very similar. It's really more on the gap lending side of things, as far as working with a trusted operator that's a flipper here in Las Vegas. But we're giving our investors an alternative to dabble in on some returns that are much faster than a 3 to 5 or 7 year hold. And then eventually those preferred fund investors, they're receiving more capital gains, and now they need to offset it by, you know, an equity ownership on another offering that we have or you may have. And so you could kind of like ping pong the offerings with just one set of investor. I think it's brilliant. Great.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Man, Anthony and I, we could talk to you for hours. And I think, you know, we've done that in the past. We've talked for hours. Definitely. I know you and I, we hop on random phone calls and we literally just shoot the breeze with one another. And sometimes we're talking about stuff outside of real estate. Mm-hmm. But before we dive into our lightning round, Adam, I think I know the question, but what is your superpower?
Ooh. Superpower. Wow. not a question I've mentally prepared for. I would say empathy. You know, I think I can, you know, feel people, and especially, you know, with investors, understand, you know, where they're coming from and what they really need with things. I think that's sort of something I learned in Wall Street, and I think it's carried with me over to real estate.
You never know what the next person's walk is looking like. Having empathy is, you know, that's something that I'm trying to work on myself, Adam. So I need to talk to you more about that. So now these next two questions, Adam, they're most likely going to be the most difficult questions you've ever been asked. Are you ready?
Let's go.
I think your life experience has prepared you for this. You're stuck on an island, all remote. Not a single soul on the island. No family, no friends, no peers, not a single soul. However, you are able to bring your iPhone. On your iPhone, you don't have data. You cannot make phone calls, but you can load up one musical artist or one musical album on your phone that you can listen to on repeat forever until you finally get rescued. Who is that artist, or what is that album that you can listen to on repeat forever?
Love the question. And I think you'll be surprised by my answer. Shakira.
Oh yeah.
I am a Shakira fan. I've seen her
really
four times. I have tickets to see her when she's back in Phoenix on the 7th. Yeah, that's lover. So that's my music down list on my if I'm stuck on an island.
Awesome, man. That's why we love asking these questions. You know, we get to really get to know our investors and you know, on a personal level.
Yep. Let me ask you this. Does your Shakira fan on the dance floor, does your hips lie?
Oh, I can shake. I have it.
That's funny.
My daughter hasn't seen it yet. I'm sure I you know, the daddy-daughter dance I've never done. I didn't want to embarrass her, but my wife certainly has seen it, so she approves.
I think our kids would want to just run away if they see our hips shaking.
Oh, for certain, yeah. My daughter is 12 now. I don't want to, you know, she's at that daddy, oh, yeah, don't embarrass me. Don't, yeah.
She's at that age already where, yeah, don't embarrass me, exactly. So my question is, are you a tropical person or more of a mountainous area? And if so, where is your bucket list? Where would you go?
I'm definitely tropical. I love warm weather. You know, when we moved, when we were leaving New York, when we were choosing where to go to, you know, the first thing I said was warm weather. That was the first check box for me. And the second one was, I need enough of a city still. I need to make sure that there's, you know, four major sports teams. Unfortunately, we just lost the Coyotes, but I want to make sure that there was enough, you know, sports, concerts, that type of stuff. So I'm definitely tropical. So bucket list, where is the one place this is a new place, some place I've never been to.
Yeah, I think, okay. I would say.
You know, I've always wanted to go to Australia. That's sort of been one of my places. You hear about the Great Barrier Reef, seeing that. That's, you know, I would say Australia is the one place that I would just love to go to.
Yeah, Australia is beautiful.
Oh, you've been?
Yeah, I've been there a couple of times. I went to Sydney, and I have family there. So my family is in Perth, which is Western Australia.
Yeah, I was going to say the other side. Wow.
Yeah, but it's... Yeah, scary though. Don't be in the ocean too long. You know, the sharks, the great whites.
What's that? The octopus is what scares me the most. The octopus in that little shell, that little conch.
Oh yeah, okay. Good stuff, man.
So Adam, how can people get a hold of you, whether it's social media, websites, and also maybe to learn more about you and also learn about investment opportunities with Break a Day Capital?
Sure. Well, yes. I mean, I am on LinkedIn for certain, and I connect with anybody ever sends out the request. I definitely connect with them. But you know, people can definitely email me or even just call me. I mean, my email is an easy one to remember. It's, you know, it's adam@breakofdaycapital.com. And you know, my number's on everything as well. It's 602-529-2056. People can call me either, call or text me at that number. So whatever way works for people, I'm willing to you know, communicate and get in touch with.
Love it, Adam. You know, I just want to say thank you for taking the time for blessing us again, Adam. You were there in the beginning stages of our journey. And now, a few years later, we're now seeing you flourish on the equity side of things. So we're very excited for you. What you guys are doing at Break a Day Capital, it's very inspiring, you know, definitely for Anthony and myself. And shout out to Guido as well. You know, we get to keep a good pulse of the Tucson market. But on that note, guys, for those listening at home, this is another episode of the Nine Doors Down show. Please like and share our podcast with your friends and family or whoever else you think may find value. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, the list goes on. So on that note, this is another episode of the Nine Doors Down show. We out.
Peace.